feet for. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's on 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist, and a Baptist, and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting in Canada, he's fighting in France, he's fighting in the USA. This way, and he's fighting for democracy or fighting for the red. He says it for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, in a war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from him and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end.
Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. Last week, I told you about an interesting movie, The Conspirator. Well, it seems that my wife and I got into a post-Civil War mode as we then proceeded to watch every episode of Hell on Wheels. It turns out that that's a current series on AMC, so now we're caught up in having to wait. Very strange for us. Usually we're used to watching things that are finished already. Anyway, it's a very interesting look at the ruthless and somewhat insane people that were out there all trying to push their own personal agendas at the expense of everyone else. There was lots of skullduggery, plots upon plots, people selling secrets themselves, booze, all trying to push this train through. Well, you talk about your interesting times. Even the wackiness of today may pale next to those folks. Maybe it's just a bit more hidden today. You know, even with the increasing use of the big lie in today's times, there are still some attempts to get us to look the other way. Well, sometimes. Anyway, thinking that we might continue our Civil War era movie fest, this morning we tried a movie called The Lincoln Lawyer. Well, guess what? Lincoln in that one is a Lincoln Town Car. And the lawyer is a pretty likable guy. He's a strange guy. He does his magic from the back of his car. That's his office. It was a fun movie, but it definitely broke our pattern of the Civil War. Lorraine, my wife, watches her movies from morning to night. I try to share some of them with her because the way we grab a little time together. Rest of the time, well, I'm mostly sitting here with my computers, editing, writing, doing websites, reading, sometimes just surfing. Fun, mostly. Sometimes I feel like people might be out there listening or reading, might actually make a difference for something. I really hope so. Why I do it. Certainly not for the money, which is generally flowing out, rather. Now, in our economy, money flowing out is pretty typical for most of us. Typical for 99.9% of us who aren't super rich. It's typical for the 47% that Mitt Romney says don't matter at all. Yeah, money flowing out is the normal thing. Tonight we're going to have some activists on the show. People who, like us, are trying to make a difference, trying to change the world to a better place. Let's listen to what Bill Hicks said a few years back.
It's just a ride, and we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek.
I'm Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream radio show. And now I'd like to welcome my friend and co-host, Mike Pelichek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome our special guest, Michael Annis. I think Michael will be talking to us from Denver. He's Howling Dog Press publisher. He's also a poet. He'll read from us and tell us about the Cost of Freedom book. It was a book that he published. I was part of that. It was back in, I think it was 2007. We're also welcome Daniel Hazen. He's currently active working as a human rights activist, advocate, organizer, nationally and internationally. Daniel has experience advocating and organizing for human rights and ending the horrific actions of forced psychiatric interventions and human rights violations in both the psychiatric and prison industries. So tonight we're gathering together for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Denver, and I believe Daniel is in New York, in New York City or New York State, and also wherever you are. Websites of articles of particular note. I'd like to mention one tonight. It's on the Veterans Today website. Gordon Duff is the author, and the title is called Top Senator Calls for Investigation of Bush False Flag Terror Plot. And I think that's a pretty important one. And I have an editorial comment. The Second Amendment, deer hunters say the government can't take away our guns because we will fight. And so we need assault weapons for when that big day comes. When actually for 30-plus years, this has already taken place for a generation by Americans, nonviolently revolt, fighting against the U.S. militarism, and fighting against spending our resources on weapons of mass destruction rather than schools, healthcare, children, families, jobs, homes, all the good stuff. Because there is no money left over from our spending on bad stuff, the military and its weapons. Shock and awe. These Plowshares Movement folks gathered a couple of years ago to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the first plowshares at the General Electric plant at King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, when 8 people sneaked in and pounded on cruise missile parts with hammers and were arrested and served time. And since then, there have been dozens and dozens of like protests, but we hear nothing about them. Because our media is like Tass and Izvestia, and we do not live in a democracy. We have a rich history, but it's only covered in samizdat, only to be found by chasing after a loose piece of paper in the parking lot of Walmart or in the back of a liquor store receipt in Pine Ridge or in the cardboard sign of a homeless woman in Seattle. The truth is out there. It is here. It exists. but the information is not to be found in your local paper, on your television, or on your radio. It's just not. And yet it does exist. It is important for our sanity, I believe, to know that somewhere there is something rock solid that is real. Everything is not fog and mist and unknowing and uncertainty and vagueness and black helicopters here, men in black over there, chemtrails up there. Something is solid. There is bedrock to be found. You dig? Okay. Quickly onward, I wanted to say something, as I had mentioned last week, something about why I think all the things I think about are country and government like conspiracies. One reason people might think that is just because of being curious. You want to know the truth. You just have to know, even though knowing is so elusive. And so I do read and read and read. And over years, for one thing, after a while, you have read quite a bit. Not sure if that translates to knowing, but it's a start, I suppose. The other thing, I guess, would be personal experience. The way to really know what's going on, of course, would be to be some sort of an insider. Then you actually know. That would be so cool to actually know. But for some reason, those people don't talk. They don't tell the rest of us, and so we are, for the most part, relegated to trying to figure things out on our own. We look around, and from what we can see, the traffic runs orderly, and the birds are chirping, and there's milk in the fridge, so what's the big prob? Or maybe you read and experience and just kind of figure something's not quite right, and you walk down your front steps and go try to figure it out. Or maybe you don't decide, but things just happen to you that make you wonder, and it kind of draws you in. Well, for me, I don't really know how I happened to be interested in things. It wasn't always that way, for sure. I grew up in a small Midwestern town, small family, Catholic grade school. My father was an engineer for the Chicago Northwestern Railroad. My mother was a stay-at-home mom. Their house rent was $50 a month. That was the 50s and 60s. We came in from catching fireflies in the yard to watch Neil Armstrong tell us he was on the moon. We watched Martin King march to Selma. The Green Bay Packers win the first Super Bowl, John Kennedy's funeral parade, RFK lying on his back in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel, all on the little black and white TV in our living room. When my mom and dad took me to my first professional baseball game in Minneapolis, the thing I remember was the color of the Twins and Orioles uniforms in the green grass. I guess I thought the game was played in black and white. I thought mostly everything was black and white growing up in the 50s and 60s in Norfolk, Nebraska. I played baseball, football, basketball, tried to run track, drank beer, rode the Maine in my 56 Chevy station wagon, black and white. And me and all my friends would have no doubt gone to Vietnam without questioning, because that's who we were. It was football season, you tossed the football, baseball, you got up teams for a game in the park. War season, you learn how to kill, maybe get killed. But the war ended. Some hippie stuck his head in the English room door and said, "The war is over." Me and my friends kind of looked around at each other and said, "What war?" I graduated about 283 out of class of 287, went to junior college, flunked all my classes both semesters, then finally went to a nearby state college and graduated. Then I went on some sort of vision quest that involved a new cowboy hat, a dog, a 59 Chevy Impala, and a monastery in Oregon that wouldn't let me keep the dog. And then I found my way to Minnesota, and it was like a whole new world, like I had landed on another planet. Minnesota was as different from Nebraska as the moon would have been to Neil Armstrong had he actually gone there. Everything was in full color, just like the new Walt Disney TV show, 6:30 p.m. every Sunday night. Well, before the Oregon trip, I had just broken up with my girlfriend, and I decided I wanted to be a priest. I don't remember quite why. I do remember something about wanting to go all the way. It was probably the be-all-you-can-be thing at that time, and I thought that was the priesthood. It could have been obsessive mental illness aborting. I've heard sometimes it happens in late teens and early 20s, who knows. I kind of suspect I've had something of that my whole life. Well, in seminary, I met Father Daniel Berrigan. I was going to school at St. Thomas, and Berrigan came to speak in McAllister just up the road, up Summit Avenue. I remember that because that is where my education began, I think. Berrigan came to do an impromptu talk with us at the dorm. And the things he said about the Catholic Church, America, the military, our history, well, it just started me on the way of questioning a lot of things. At that time, Dan Berrigan had already done the Catonsville action and been famous on the cover of Time magazine with his brother Phil and all kinds of big national attention during the Vietnam War years. And yet, I had never heard of him in my Nebraska cloister. And so after that, the seminary sponsored a carload going to Chicago for a protest at an arms bazaar, and I went. I'd never been to Chicago or to a protest. and then at Easter break, rather than going home, I went with another seminarian on a train to Washington, D.C. for the annual protest gathering at St. Stephen's Church, the Berrigan brothers and others. We protested at the White House. I remember sitting in the planning meetings with people I would read about for the next many years, Carl Cabot, Elizabeth McAllister, Sister Ann Montgomery, Art Laffin, Phil Berrigan, Dan Berrigan. I remember walking up to Phil Berrigan when he arrived at the church and asking him about 100 questions right in a row. And he took the time to sit with me in a pew in the middle of the church and answer my questions. When we got on the bus outside of St. Stephen's, we boarded, on our way to the White House, that is, we boarded our as small groups, not one large group, in order to not give away our protests. It was the same as when we stood in line for the White House tour and also inside the White House. I thought that was so cool to be on the inside of those goings-on. I saw Father Carl Cabot get arrested on that White House tour for unfurling a banner. We held signs also outside the Pentagon and inside the Pentagon. It was all very heady stuff. It gave me a lot to think about. I later went on to leave the seminary after getting my teeth cleaned by a pretty dental hygienist during summer break. I guess I just like clean teeth. And then later I got involved with protests at Offutt Air Force Base near Omaha, Nebraska, got arrested, went to jail. Maybe I'll say a little bit about that next week. Thanks. Okay, back to you, Chuck.
Now, it's time for another segment of We Are So Not Nazis. We Are So Not Nazis is brought to you each week by the good folks at Powder Milk Wiener Schnitzel. Abbott, they're tasty. Expeditious. And the final solution against hunger. We Americans are the peculiar chosen people, the Israel of our time. They're the ark of the liberties of the world. God has predestined mankind expects great things from our race, great things we feel in our souls. What Melville said that.
I take the Bible, and all evening long I read the simplest and greatest sermon that has ever been given to mankind, the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are they who suffer persecution for the sake of justice, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Joseph Goebbels.
Most of its citizens, America is exceptional, and it's only natural it should take exception to certain international standards. A Washington Post columnist.
We have a feeling that Germany has been transformed into a great house of God, including all classes, professions, and creeds, where the Fuhrer, as our mediator, stood before the throne of the Almighty. Joseph Goebbels, in a broadcast April 19, 1936.
Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters, U.S. Army War College in 1997, our country is a force for good without precedent. Thomas Barnett, U.S. Naval College. The U.S. military is a force for global good that has no equal.
God gave the Savior to the German people. We have faith, deep and unshakable faith, that he, Hitler, was sent to us by God to save Germany. Hermann Göring.
President George W. Bush said he didn't want other countries dictating terms or conditions for the war on terrorism. At some point, we may be the only ones left. That's okay with me. We're America. Washington Post, January 31, 2002.
Make the lie big. Make it simple. Keep saying it, and eventually they will believe it. Adolf Hitler.
Colin Powell. Speaking before the Republican National Convention, August 13, 1996. The United States is a country that exists by the grace of a divine providence.
All propaganda has to be popular and has to accommodate itself to the comprehension of the least intelligent of those whom it seeks to reach, Adolf Hitler. The victor will never be asked if he told the truth, Adolf Hitler. Through clever and constant application of propaganda, people can be made to see paradise as hell, and also the other way around, to consider the most wretched sort of life as paradise, Adolf Hitler.
If we have to use force, It's because we are America. We are the indispensable nation. Stand tall. We see further into the future. Madeleine Albright, U.S. Secretary of State, 1998.
Tune in next week for another episode of We Are So Not Nazis, when we will see George W. Bush chasing a weapons of mass destruction sniffing German Shepherd around the White House and trying to text his father, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama at the same time.
In 2007, a very interesting anthology was published by Howling Dog Press called The Cost of Freedom. This anthology, well, it's 100 different contributors telling us about the cost of freedom that isn't cheap, shock and awe, aggression. Well, I'm going to let Michael Annis tell you about it. Michael Annis is with us. He's the publisher of Howling Press. Michael, are you there? Michael,
hello?
Are you there?
Yes,
hello,
I am.
Michael? Okay,
yeah, hi.
Good. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. We're connected now.
Okay, good.
I'm glad this is a laid-back show, Chuck.
Oh, of course. We keep everything pretty casual. Michael, why don't you tell us about the project, how it started, and why it's still relevant?
Okay, I'll be glad to. Actually, I had published Mike Palachek's Looking for Bigfoot in 2005, and it was a very, very fine novel, about the metaphorical or allegorical search for America with Bigfoot acting as the symbol for that, the lost America, the mythology. After that was published, we stayed in correspondence very regularly, daily, I would say, and he came up about 6 months later, maybe a year, with this idea for an anthology of a peace and activist anthology, which he wanted to call Cost of Freedom or The Cost of Freedom. And submitted the material that and the idea to me, and I read it over, and I thought it was well worth taking time and money to do, and to try to collaborate with him on this, not only as a publisher but also as a co-editor. He had also, at that time, hooked up through email with a young woman, a student, very brilliant student, Whitney Tretine, from Maryland, who eventually became a Truman Scholar and now works primarily with understanding the construct of language and so on. But she was very politically motivated and very much a political activist. And the three of us working together over the course of, I told them that they could gather actual letters, documents from protesters, and that I would handle works by poets, in poets in protest, and artists in protest. So we kind of divided it up into areas of responsibility to produce this anthology. And as I was heard you say, yeah, there's well over 100 contributors from the United States and Canada that participated in this, and some were well-known, some not so well-known, but, every single one of them that contributed to the anthology was important in their own way and in their own light, and that's what made it such, or makes it, I should say, because it's definitely still relevant, that's what makes it such a shining light in such a world of publishing darkness. For the most part, when you're looking at corporately controlled publishing houses, which my press, Howling Dark Press, which has been in operation since 1981, is anything but corporately controlled. So this is basically how the idea came about. Like I said, Mike was the originator, and he came to me with the idea. We got in collaboration with Whitney. We thought it was very important to hear the voice as an editor or co-editor of a young person, a college student, since so much of what happened in the 1960s, of course, sprang forth from the colleges and universities. It was the young people. And, you know, it's still, to a degree, it still is and can be and should be, because they are the ones who are going to inherit this mess, this absolute atrocious state of affairs that we find ourselves in now, that we're calling a nation and a government and so on. So that's essentially the origin of Cost of Freedom, the Anthology of Peace and Activism.
Is it true that there are over 100 different people represented in this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you go through the table of contents, you'll see like 160, I think, what is it, 165 entries.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's well over 100 people, and it's all from across the United States and Canada. And the works are original. There are stories, there are articles, there are essays, there are autobiographical-type accounts of being out on the front lines of activism and protest. And so there's poems and artworks. So it's, yeah, there was just, oh, well, way, way over 100 contributors. And I'm very, of course, to be a contributor besides being, you know, an editor and publisher.
Right. The logistics of putting this thing together must have been mind-boggling.
Yeah, it was pretty much of a monumental task. Fortunately, I had a couple of decades worth of collaboration and holding seminars on collaboration, the value of collaboration, being able to collaborate with large numbers of and groups of people, and assembling things that might otherwise not. I've worked on many other anthologies, most for myself, some for other people. But, yeah, it becomes quite an imposing task, and you know, unless you have a background in it. But it worked, and it came out, and when it came out, it was beautiful, and we had nothing but incredible testimonial blurbs by some really interesting people. You know, I mean, people who, Noam Chomsky and Ralph Nader and Harry Belafonte and Tom Hartman and a former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, all contributed, you know, Pete Seeger, all contributed these testimonials about how important this book, this anthology was or is, still is.
If you would be so kind, I'd appreciate it if you would share with us two or three of the blurbs, and then I think you had in mind to read part of the introduction.
Yes, I did. Okay, yeah, I would love to do that. Noam Chomsky, I'll start off with him. Okay, he probably has 100 solicitations at least a week for people wanting him to do some kind of blurb, make a statement on their books, to testify in their about the importance of their book or the relevance of their book. And so we felt very, very honored that he, out of so many that quite probably had been submitted to him at the same time, that he had decided that he wanted to do a blurb for us. And so I'll read, this is the first one is by Noam Chomsky, and he says, quote, "This varied and exciting collection graphically reveals the vitality and expanse of the popular movements opposing violence and criminal ventures abroad. it should inspire many more to join in these efforts to create a powerful force of concerned citizens that cannot be ignored and that will help shape a much more hopeful and decent future, end quote. And that is so important, what he said there, because, I mean, that is where my heart is right now. In fact, I was going to speak exactly to that. I had made some notes prior to the show. I was going to speak exactly to his sentiments, and because they really parallel my own, about the importance of activism. And that's why I chose to read the intro to the anthology, at least half of it anyway. So you want one from Ralph Nader? Are you civically indifferent to officialdom's criminality and brutality against the powerless and defenseless, against children, mothers, and fathers, against our Constitution and other laws of the land? If this collection, Cost of Freedom, of passionate and rational prose, poetry, photographs, and quotes from our courageous forebears, does not stir you to join with other patriots for democratic actions and restorations, you are indeed civically inactive, and that's no way to be self-respectful. Ralph Nader.
That's very important, too, because, you know, we've, most of us at least, have been civically inactive for years. I know it's only in the last 2 or 3 years that I've actually started to try to make my voice heard again. Before that, it was marching against Vietnam. That's quite a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's typical of many of us in my generation. It's time for us to get out there and do something.
Oh, yeah, and what we have to remember, I think, Chuck, more than anything else, is that, you know, using quotes here, the enemy never sleeps. I'm not talking about some nation overseas. I'm not talking about Al-Qaeda. I'm not talking about any of that stuff. What I'm talking about is I'm talking about a mentality, a mindset, which raises greed and self-serving action against and over actions and philosophies and attitudes of humanity, brotherhood, union, and so forth. Those guys, they are never asleep. They have always got something in the works. This is not to say that we should be paranoid, but we have to remain vigilant. You know, the revolution, the American Revolution, is an ongoing thing. And, I mean, I have been doing this as a publisher since 1981. And since 1981, I have been publishing piece after piece after piece of activist poetry and activist art to say that you can't sleep, because when you sleep, those who bring the nightmares will come in and they will destroy, you know, all the things around you. You have got to be vigilant constantly, and you have to call it out. When you see it, you can't just let it go. You've got to call it out. So, and that's what attracted me to Mike's work. He was constantly doing that. And Whitney, with the same mindset that you can't sleep. You can't, you know, put down your guard. You have to be vigilant. So I think we've got a couple minutes, eh, left?
Yes.
Okay. Do you want me to read just the opening couple of paragraphs from...
Yes, I'd like you to do that, and then we'll let people know what we have planned for the next couple months.
Okay, cool. All right. This is from the opening, the book cover flaps that tell what is Cost of Freedom and why. Right. Freedom, they tell us, isn't free. The cost of freedom isn't cheap. It's shock and awe, aggression, unquestioning, proud of its country, right or wrong. It follows orders from the president to the governor to the local cop while giving orders to the rest of the world. Dominating, hard-bitten, hard-nosed, decisive, it's blood, sweat, tears, guts, and conquest. It's occupation of foreign soil for foreign oil, shrewd, brutal, relentless, merciless, and oh, so gloriously patriotic. Troop surges rolling over old folks and children is the cost of freedom. Violence, bloodshed, death, destruction, genocide, torture, incarceration of all evildoers who'd defy our decider and commander-in-chief. That's the cost of freedom. They spin as they count their profits and leave the farmers, the grocers, the postmen, the teachers, the factory workers, the students, the carpenters, the poets, the bloggers, the mothers of soldiers, and all the nameless others to mourn and bury the dead. Greater profits for oil companies and rising stock values are their determining factors for whether the nation is free or enslaved, pouring forth the sludge of nationalistic fervor through their corporate media broadcasts. America is the land of business, big business, of the trickle-down theory of economics. When corporations are healthy, America is healthy. When corporations are safe to conduct business freely, America is safe and free. When corporations find obstacles for growth, the cost of freedom is to knock down the obstructions. It's a balanced equation for a balanced budget. Just give it some time. One day it will trickle down to you. But for now, the cost of freedom is your duty, your son's duty, your daughter's, to make the world safe for corporate freedom. And you may have to freely give your children's lives and your own blood to satiate voracious corporate appetites.
Well, I tell you, that really is something. And I'm so glad we're going to be having you on two more times in the next couple of months to share some more from that book, because it really is powerful. In closing, I would like you to tell people how to buy the book.
Okay, well, the book can be ordered directly through Howling Dog Press. I don't have my books on Amazon.com, and I'll tell you why. Because it is a corporate monstrosity, and I don't sell my books through them. They are like the Walmart of the book industry, and they have destroyed so much of the book industry. They are cutthroat and so on and so forth, and I'm not going to get into that, although I have a little bit. I have a lot more to say about them. But so the best way is to go to the website, which is howlingdogpress.com, and you will find a link within the next few days. I had my website down for most of the summer, but it's coming back. It's brand new, revised, and restructured. It's offering some new books that have been currently published, and I'll have a listing of books in the past that people can purchase too. You know, another great book that we did was called, about the same time as Cost of Freedom, was called Right Wing Politics and Religion. And it really showed how so much of the religious right has deceived and been deceived by this entry into right-wing politics. And, the fellow was on Randy Rhodes. They talked about it. She felt, after he had gotten through talking about it, the author, that she said, wow, I feel clean again, because he'd exposed this. So this is just part of the history of Howling Dog Press. And Cost of Freedom is really the place to start, I think.
All right. Well, I hope that some of our listeners will find their way to the site and get themselves a copy of this excellent book that reminds us of, what the terrible price that we are paying for so-called freedom. It's not our freedom. Thank you, Michael, for being on the show, and have a good night.
Thanks, Chuck. I appreciate you asking me to be on. Thank you very much.
And now we bring you the New American Dream Masterpiece Classic Playhouse Theater Something Something. Real voices with a message that you will not hear on the CBS Nightly News. This is Philip and Daniel Berg, an American priest, activists, writers, poets. Philip was born in Two Harbors, Minnesota, north of where I'm at right now. Daniel was born in Virginia. That's also north of here, only a different way, northwest, about an hour away. Okay.
At the burning of, this is Daniel Berrigan. At the burning of draft files in a bonfire outside the draft office in Catonsville, Maryland in 1968, our apologies, good friends, for the fracture of good order, the burning of paper instead of children, the angering of the orderlies in the front parlor of the charnel house. We could not, so help us God, do otherwise. Time is past when good men can remain silent, when obedience can segregate men from public risk, when the poor can die without defense. And Daniel Berrigan again. Because we want the peace with half a heart and half a life and will, the war, of course, continues because the waging of war by its nature is total. But the waging of peace by our own cowardice is partial. Certainly the trouble is not that we do not want peace. We've seen enough war. We're sick of it unto death. The war has come home like a stalking corpse, trailing its blood, its tears, its losses, its despairs, seeking like an American ghost the soul of America. We want the peace, but most of us do not want to pay the price of peace. We still dream of a peace that has no cost attached. We want peace, but we live content with poverty and injustice and racism, with the murder of prisoners and students, the despair of the poor to whom justice is endlessly denied. We long for peace, but we wish also to keep undisturbed the social fabric of privilege and power that controls the economic misery of two-thirds of the world's people. Obviously, there will be no genuine peace while such an inherently violent scheme of things continues. America will in time extricate herself from the bloody swamps, the ruined villages, the mutilated dead of Vietnam, but nothing will be settled there, nothing mitigated at home, nothing changed, that is, until a change of heart leads us to a change of social structures in every area of our lives.
This is Philip Berrigan. Many people say nonviolent civil disobedience is no longer needed. Its use in history is over. Would you agree that part of our nonviolent resistance means we need to continue to risk arrest in opposition to nuclear weapons? I guess that was a question that he was being asked. One way to look at our responsibility is from the angle of law, Philip Berrigan says. We don't know anything about this law that we have. People who purport to be Christians don't know anything about the biblical treatment of law and the fact that human law is always under the judgment of God because it's a sign of rebellion against God. Nuclear weapons are legal, right across the board, from making and processing them to running them through Pantex down in Amarillo, Texas, and deploying them. It's all legal, every step of the way. What does this say about law? What does it say that we legalize every measure that could destroy the world? What does it mean that it is legal to destroy the world through toxic poisoning? It says something about law. It's like the law under which Christ was crucified. The ruler said, we have a law, and under this law, he has to die. He was executed legally. And this is another question. You spoke on Good Friday at the prayer service and nonviolent demonstration out at Livermore Labs in California about our call to become, like Jesus, outlaws. What did you mean by that? Philip Berrigan, I meant that we can't keep the law of God and keep human law as it stands today in the imperial United States. We have to make a choice between the two.
And now, it's time for another episode of The Adventures of Buzz the Space Dog. We've heard about the Russian space monkeys who went into outer space and didn't come back until the Soviet Union was gone, and then when they did come back, they were expecting maybe a parade or a nice dacha out on Tiger View Lane, but that didn't happen. We Americans had their own space dog program going, trying to match the Russians with similar results. When those dogs returned from having been sent up by President John F. Kennedy, splashing down after November 22, 1963, the world they returned to was barely recognizable with Lyndon Johnson in the White House. Some of those dogs took the option of shooting right back out to space. Some moved to Ukiah. Some lived on the streets for years and years. Some raced to dig up money buried in the backyard and moved to Edina. One of those was Buzz. This past week, Buzz stuck his head inside the front window curtain to watch for the mailman. It wasn't Mr. Henry Riggs today. It was another guy, a new mailman, with a sidearm. Buzz recognized the piece, very similar to what they used to use in the Alpo Space Dog program, in case the other dog went crazy, rolling something on the floor of the craft, knocking stuff over. Buzz turned the front door lock with his teeth and bounded up the stairs to his study. He began closing windows on his laptop, shoved his plastic moon rock chew toys under the bed, gathered up all the old black and white photos and memos he'd been looking at, threw them into a manila envelope, and placed it carefully behind the books on the second shelf. Knock, knock, knock! What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? Phone rang twice, then stopped. TV turned on, then off. The pearl-handled letter opener. Buzz bounced back up the carpeted steps. He heard the microwave ding and leaked to the landing and then all the way down. Again, a knock at the door, this time urgent. Buzz took a deep breath, trying to remember his training. He jumped and tried to float in air. He lay down, played dead. He took a karate kung fu stance and kicked and hurt himself. Buzz turned toward the door with theatrical resolve. He bared his teeth and opened the door, then signed for a registered letter. Have a good day, said the nameless mailman with a revolver in his belt that Buzz could now see red Pomeranian spray on the handle, now that he was a little closer. Tune in next week when Buzz gets an eye exam and opens the letter. The Adventures of Buzz the Space Dog, sponsored by the Stanley Kubrick Estate, Rocks R Us, Moon Rock Plastic Toys, and Under the Big Top Indoor Movie Lighting Systems.
Our second guest is Daniel Hazen. Daniel Hazen spent 3 years in prison and experienced firsthand the ways prison creates madness. Today he is director of Voices of the Heart, a leading support agency run by and for people in recovery from a diagnosis of mental illness. Daniel, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
I can't hear you very well. How you doing?
Great.
Great. Are you in New York City or New York State or?
I'm in Glens Falls, New York tonight, and actually on my way to New York City tomorrow morning.
Tell us, you're director of Voices of the Heart. Can you tell us what that's all about?
Voices of the Heart is a 13-year-old organization that's founded by by and people who have been labeled quote-unquote mentally ill. And we're, our organization is an advocacy organization that's organized to defend and promote people's rights who are labeled so. And currently we do many different things like human rights advocacy, as well as run a peer respite house, runaway house, for people who do not and want to escape having to go to an emergency room or escape psychiatry.
Dan, how old are you now?
I'm 42.
And you went to prison at what age?
I was, I went through the county system and then the prison system, 29 years of age. And then I had also been locked up in the psychiatric system at the start of the age of 15 on and off up to that point.
And you said you spent your largest bit was 3 years in a row. Is that how that worked out?
Yeah, I spent the longest period of time was 3 years in the New York State Corrections System, which was a mix between the corrections system and the psychiatric system, both.
And so when you got in, you were diagnosed as having a mental illness. Is that correct? By some staff member or?
I had been in the state psychiatric system when I was, a younger person. And what happens is the systems basically, which I consider industries, both systems have a way of networking. And actually, when I got to the prison, the penal system, they had known about my psychiatric label and therefore then began to use the same oppression that they had used on me as a young man in the psychiatric system.
They might have called it treatment, and you called it oppression. Tell me how it was oppression and not treatment.
Well, the first thing is that there's this way of I often actually compare the two systems and how parallel they are. But basically, when you don't take on the psychiatric labels that they would like to bestow upon you, they basically find you as incompetent. And a person who doesn't have insight, quote-unquote, into their symptoms or illness, and I use those in quotes. So I have always opposed these labels. I oppose the use of psychiatric toxic drugs in my body, the threats of electroshock, using restraints and solitary confinement, and any kind of, this aversive kind of behavior modification. These kind of procedures that humiliate and debilitate and injure people and also kill people in that process. So I experienced that's the type of oppression. And, of course, my brothers and sisters who are still today locked up face those same things.
Is it hard? I suppose you try to advocate in as many prisons as you can. Is it hard to do that, to get access to prisoners or access to information and to get your services offered inside the prisons?
Yeah, there seems to be there's this block of what people call privacy. One thing that we've been able to do is people have gotten the word that we're actually doing this kind of work, and personally and with some other friends, we have this kind of underground connection with people who are inside prisons writing us and telling the oppression that they're facing, especially many of them who are marginalized off from, like, who are in the prison system but are marginalized off into the psychiatric system inside the prison system. So we don't actually have access, and which it makes it very difficult to continue to support people. And our hope is to continue to divert people, connect with people before any of them be picked up by police with either industries.
You know, it seems that prisons are kind of popular in the U.S. Maybe they always have been, but just since the so-called war on drugs in the 80s, and there's a lot of there's a lot of prison shows, inside prison shows on television. Would you say that, what do you think about, is there such thing as a prison industrial complex where do you think it possibly it's being perpetuated in order to make because of the financial benefit to whomever?
Oh, I mean, it's just a, when you walk in, you can just see it, feel it, and it is an industrial complex. And I think any institutions that are created today are part of that institutional complex, and it's about economics. I mean, we're seeing here in the United States a huge amount of our state institutions now being taken over by private enterprise, and so the people have become the commodity, they're not seen as human beings; they're seen as an economic, dollar sign. And obviously, the states are seeing that, and they're saying, "Hey, let's put these off into private prisons, even private emergency rooms, psychiatric centers." I mean, we're just seeing this go on juvenile justice system, I could go on into, young people's homes and things like this. I mean, it's just a giant institutional complex.
Do you think we have to close pretty soon? But I just have a couple more questions. Do you think the prisons can be reformed, or do they have to be abolished? And is that even, to even talk about abolishment of prisons in the United States, I suppose it's a pie in the sky, but you have to talk about it first, right?
Yeah, I think, I believe in abolition. I believe in the institutions being shut down, that communities can take responsibility for supporting one another. I do believe in that there's different forms of justice, I hope what will happen is I think we have to dismantle, the industrial complex. We're talking about major, fiscal ties between institutions, researchers, this pharmaceutical industry, and we could go on and on for all the connections between those, the penal system, and both the psychiatric systems.
Well, Daniel, I have to close, but thank you for your work. And could you tell people how to get in touch with you and with your different groups you're involved with?
Yes, for sure. I should say this. And on October 6th, we're having this demonstration outside of New York City at the United Nations Plaza, and it's a rally, march, and protest for human rights. We're asking for all solidarity and all unity from all movements. Anybody can reach me at, actually, I'll give two contact pieces. It's danhaysus@yahoo.com. And then as well as my contact information is 518-932-3137. And one place that they can reach us is www.occupypsychiatry.net. And at this event, we'll be calling for, this is a peaceful protest for solidarity and unity with all movements and all communities to come together to end institutional oppression.
Daniel, thank you for your work and for staying strong through all you've been through. And I hope you'll be able to come back and talk to us again. Have a good night.
You too. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
What it be like? I'm Barack Obama. How far we've come. They shot Martin Luther King Jr. on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis because he was going to lead a poor people's march to Washington and get the streets fixed in Detroit. He was getting that close to changing America, and that's why things had to go down like they did, man. Let's be reasonable. We're all intelligent people here. We see what's going on, the culture, realities, the signs. They will kill me too if I don't do what they say. I don't want to die. I will do whatever they say. I will say whatever I'm told. My children are young and should not die. They are not much older or younger than your children, right? Osama bin Laden has been buried at sea. The 9/11 attacks were perpetrated by 19 Muslim hijackers with box cutters. See how far we've come? It's all good. So when I smile and wave, that will be our little signal for you to do what I say, and really, nobody gets hurt. Vote for me, Obama Biden, 2012, for hope, for change.
And now, please join us for another episode of Beltway Sandy Snore Journalism Horror. When we last left Sandy, he had just received, as he sat with a friend at the Bulldog Bistro in downtown D.C., a subpoena to appear at the next session of the House Un-American Activities Commission. He read the formal paper silently, while his prime rib cooled to the taste of prime tuna. The committee will be reconvening next week to investigate un-American activities such as the murder of children in Iraq and Afghanistan, the restricting of personal freedoms in the United States through the so-called Patriot Act, as well as the infiltration of American organizations by members of certain domestic clandestine terror groups. Are you now, or have you ever been, a member of the Central Intelligence Agency? Sandy smiled wanly at his companion, folded the paper neatly, placed it into his inside jacket pocket. He made a comment about the dessert, ordered a nice Bordeaux. The next day, Sandy began to stoically prepare for the end. The stupid provincial song that had played on the car radio kept repeating in his head. You had but one day to live, dude. What would you do? What would you do, dude? He found the paper on thick vanilla paper, tossed onto his desk. He unfolded it, read it again, set it down, looked at himself in the mirror as if for the last time. He took a cab, stared out his window at the activity, now wishing he'd done more, loved more, got more involved with people. He'd missed them, it seemed. In the so-called green room, Sandy sat on a plush chair with the others. The chairs pushed back against the wall in almost a perfect circle. One chair absent, like a missing tooth, Sandy noted. Sandy knew many of those in the other chairs, sitting with their hands on their knees, their heads down. Some were famous, some not so much. One by one, the other journalists left the room when called. They were told to bring with them whatever they'd brought, and they did not return. At the end, it was just Sandy Van Snore and a woman from National Public Radio he talked to one time at a party for the senator from Carolina. What was his name? He smiled at her. She nodded back. Their eyes told all that needed to be said about the lost chance at the cocktail party for that one senator. The gallows steps they were both about to climb. She held out her hand and he gripped it and wiped his hand down his pants as subtly as he could manage. The woman from NPR, who he could not quite get her name into his memory, she was called. Sandy ran through the alphabet in his head, trying to get at least her first name, and remembered, well, what the heck, she's gone. They're all gone. He looked around the room and heard his name. Mr. Van Snore? Mr. Van Snore? He looked at the young woman at the door, rose and followed her into the bright light as the condemned behind the sad hooded priest. The big bright room was busy and bustling with young men and women holding papers, hurrying back and forth, like worker ants with bits of leaf and sticks in their mouths. Someone touched Sandy by the tip of his elbow and by that slight pressure, it was able to direct him wherever he needed to go, around tables, feet, canes, to a seat in the front row, facing the HUAC. Sandy sat, folded his hands atop the table. He could only hope that he appeared sane, calm, innocent, found his bearings. Without turning his head, he sighted up and down and around at the journalists kneeling and seated, aiming cameras at him, at the microphones up and down this long table, at the committee members across from him talking over their shoulders, accepting pieces of paper from young people, at the empty chair right in front of him. Someone, somewhere, pounded a gavel, and the room began to quiet. More pounding. And that noise gradually subsided, like the waves in the big wave pool at 5 o'clock. A man to the side, Sandy's right of the empty chair, pulled his microphone toward himself. He looked right at Sandy as if Sandy were the only one in the room, the most important. Sandy wondered if he might be a psychiatrist. He'd make a good one. The man told Sandy that the chairwoman of the committee had wished very much to be here today, but on her way here this morning from her home state, her small plane crashed in a forest. There were no survivors, the man said. Sandy gasped, his mouth dropped open. He looked around the room and saw that everyone was busy doing something else, just keeping very quiet about it. He was the last to know. He looked back at the man who appeared to have taken over as head of the committee. Sandy drew a deep breath as he prepared for the coming grilling, the questions, the admonitions from the remaining committee members up and down the line. One woman in a green suit, three to the left of the empty chair, dragged her microphone over the wood, sending a squeak across the room and over the international airwaves. Mr. Van Snore, you are... Her words echoed and squeaked, and Sandy stared at her and saw himself shuffling up the prison steps, wearing an orange jumpsuit, his hands cupped at his waist. A flock of pigeons stir for a moment and sit back down as Sandy and his escorts passed on their way to the cold steel penitentiary front door. You are the most entertaining media guest on the late night talk shows. I have to say, we just love it, my family and I. What I have to ask is, you write those top 10 lists yourself? Sandy answered the question as best he could, and then another from another committee member about being an Ivy League football star. And did he ever wish he'd gone into the NFL rather than into journalism? A short congressman from a southwest state down the line asked Sandy if he tried to match his ties to any particular season or event, and then they were out of time. On his way out, a congressman from Idaho asked Sandy how he got those front row seats at the Nationals games. I see you on TV, the congressman said, as he was whisked away by a young staff member to another meeting. Sandy stood alone in front of the big stone building, turned to face the street. He waved the cab on and walked toward a place he knew. He sat at the bar, looking up at the TV, sat and stared and sipped. He watched the news, wondering about the committee chairwoman, about what had happened to the others in the green room. He watched until the news turned into lead-in music for Survivor Borneo, then swiveled around, put his elbows on the bar, looked around to search for anyone he knew. Join us next week for more, another episode of Sandy Van Snore Journalism Horror, when we find Sandy lost in bumper-to-bumper beltway traffic, late for an appointment and having to pee.
And now we bring you the New American Dream big commercial sponsored by Budweiser, Gillette, Chevrolet, Ford, Studebaker, Google, Nike, CNN, and lots of other people who bring you this real person who really can say these things on regular American TV to millions of people and nobody gets fired or killed.
Richard Dolan is among the world's most prominent UFO researchers and is considered by many to be the world's preeminent historian of the subject. The moment of disclosure of the existence of UFOs is not the end of anything. It's the beginning of the real fight for truth. Demonstrations of a million people in Tahrir Square. Don't you think there might be a march of a million people on Area 51? Patterson Air Force Base? Los Alamos? Maybe. I bet you Whack and Huck security can stop a march of 100 people, but not a million. Not a million. And don't you think that just might happen? And what about opening up a new truth movement? Because after UFOs, then 9/11, JFK, underground bases, you name it, trails, it's all going to be on the table. My God, what an exciting and challenging mess it's going to be. And so, in other words, the moment of disclosure is not going to be the end of anything. It's the beginning for the real fight for truth, not the end.
Well, it's been a long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. It's election season in Washington, D.C., in Ames, Iowa, and Amarillo, Mount Liberty. Mount Liberty and the Congressional District have a new candidate. Joe Coffey might be called a non-traditional candidate. It's kind of the way they refer to the older folks taking education and sociology classes over at Wayne State College. Joe is, well, what is Joe anyway? He is a family man with problems fitting in. He would have been a hero of Bukowski if Bukowski would have ever heard of him or if he'd ever heard of Bukowski. Joe is no Joe America. He's not a father you'd find in the front yard smoking a pipe, stopping the lawnmower in his crisp white T-shirt for a moment to chat with the neighbors. Some say if God had wanted us to vote, he would have sent us candidates. Well, maybe he sent us one, just the one, to see how we would handle it. Joe used to live in Omaha in a commune, they called it, a resistance community. They fought the Air Force for planning to nuclear bomb the world, and they fought the Catholic Church for not giving a shit about the Air Force preparing to bomb the world and spending all those billions of dollars on the bombs and the planes rather than the poor black neighborhoods of North Omaha. Things went bad in Omaha, and Joe and his wife and kids moved away. Joe thinks his best friend got killed by someone, maybe the FBI, after he and his friend had occupied the Catholic Cathedral trying to fight the church and the Air Force. Joe got away and he lived to tell about it, but both days he'd rather have died. They moved to Mount Liberty and tried to live the good life, the peacenik and the gray flannel suit, trying to ignore the world for 10 minutes and enjoy peace and quiet and a well-mowed lawn. It was driving Joe crazy, it seems. Years later, the Strategic Air Command was still a booming business, and Father Carney was now the bishop. Father Rick, the education archbishop, the World Herald had tagged him. The special agent in charge had moved to Minneapolis to manage the FBI's campaign against the release of Leonard Peltier from Lewisburg. The old three-story resistance community on North 18th Street had been annexed by Creighton University Philosophy Fraternity, and life was good. And Joe lay on the sofa for 14 years thinking about Charles McNulty Calhoun. To die, to be a martyr. Hadn't the nuns raised them to want to be martyrs? They had turned against their own church, the families had said, but they didn't get it. They certainly didn't care if the church said nothing about North Omaha starving while off at Air Force Base at the south end, spent billions, billions on weapons that are supposed to kill. Thou shalt not kill. At church the other day, Jane and Joe had become Methodists and compromised to give the kids some kind of church. The girls had recited the Ten Commandments, and Joe was surprised to hear it was now thou shalt not murder. Very convenient for the warden at Huntsville and the commander at Offutt and the president who bombs Pakistan or Tripoli or anywhere he wants. Now it's thou shalt not murder. Joseph Stephen Coffey thought about killing every day. Killing himself, but thou shalt not kill. The nun said that each day that Joe woke up and he asked himself on the way to the bathroom if they were better off without him or with him. But he stayed. He drank coffee with Jane, managed a few jokes, and fashioned a plan to get through the day. Jane stayed too and worked her ass off. She smiled and decorated and repaired the old house. made it look great on Christmas and apologized to her family because Joe was too depressed to attend a birthday party or graduation. He's got to work. He's got a paper out, she said as they turned their backs to laugh. She stood tall and firm, not getting angry, not making excuses, not backing down. Joe delivered the Sioux Falls Argus Leader and the Sioux City Journal on one large motor route covering 70 miles around Mount Liberty. He finished before dawn in time to get the kids ready for school and to be home in case the FBI came, which they had not, were not. So now who was he? Who the hell are you, Joe Coffey? They didn't come. They never were coming. And you deliver papers and sleep. For 10, 11, 12 years, your old high school friends are talking about retirement plans. You haven't started yet. To die for the cause, to fight the bloody British and die. And the lads drink a pint in your name and sing your praises many nights because you were the one. You were the one who wouldn't give in, who wouldn't give up, who was funny and proud and strong and tough and had balls of fucking steel, who understood the United States of America and all its non-glory, who hated its holidays, its Thanksgivings and Christmases and New Year's, its Veterans Day, Flag Day, Memorial Day, all its television days and war days. You were the one who knew and who was a rock. You were dead. What a life. But to live, oh. To exist in July or August or January in Nebraska on a clear, crystal afternoon and to be sitting at home with sleep in your eyes as your children come home from a busy, happy day, to look out the back door and see the evenly distributed clean snow and to understand that this would not end, that you would not be getting work soon, that you would not be selling hardware or editing the local paper, that you were not eligible for that life because you were crazy, because you had not died those years ago on a crisp night in Omaha. Anyone who did not die that night does not deserve to live, does not deserve a good life. We could milk cows, she cooed into his ear as if saying, let's make love.
Cows, milk. Everything in Joe's view was white. The curtain, the frost, the snow, the people. He turned around within her grasp, pinned his chin to his chest to look her in the eyes, and wrapped his arms around her waist. Holden grabbed his wrist with a circle of her right hand. Joe could read her mind through those hopeful eyes. He'd make a wonderful dairyman. He got out there in the cold and started to learn the personalities of the cows. And they'd have NPR on instead of Paul Harvey. He'd love it. But he'd have to put the paper out. I'm going to run for Congress, he said. Jane scowled as if trying to hear better. She dropped her arm and stepped back, forcing Joe to let loose. What? She said. He took another half step in retreat. He shoved her arms into her front pockets. They were almost the same height, which made him an average 5'10 and she a stylish model. When they were married, after Joe came in from the hideout cabin, they had the same long hair. Hers blondish brown, his brownish red. They looked like two ponies at Dorothy Day card table altar. Jane and Joe looked and acted like siblings, some said. A married couple that started out looking alike with their elfish noses and dimpled chins and bright, curious eyes. Though Joe's eyes had since died. You're kidding, she said. Well, no. Not really. He turned and faced the window. God, why not? He balled his hands and ground his teeth. Jane seemed to be counting her breaths. She pushed up her eyebrows and responded once again to the subliminal freeze frame of her father coaxing her to jump into his arms from the second-story bedroom window the Christmas night when their house burned. In one taker bound, she covered the 8 feet between them, once again wrapped her arms around him. He struggled, and she pulled tighter. She rested her chin on his shoulder and spoke into his ear. "Run for Congress," she whispered. She squeezed him tighter. She pressed her chin into his shoulder. Tears slid down his face, off his chin and onto her hair. She rubbed her face into his shoulder. "Run for Congress and win. Kick their butts."
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO replacement referees are about average.
We thank you for joining us for the New American Dream Radio Show this week. Hope you'll join us again next week. Same time, same place. We'd like to thank WorldNewsTrust.com for hosting our websites and all of our other sponsors over the years. And, of course, June2508.com. Thank you, Mike, and have a good night.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm down there. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
Oh.